Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we debut another episode in our podcast series, Outdoorsy, and learn where to take your dog hiking in the Sierra, and some helpful do's and don'ts when it comes to bringing Fido along on your adventure. We'll also talk to a couple of local authors taking part in this weekend's Book Hop event in Fresno, essayist Armin Bacon and children's book illustrator and author Doug Hansen. They both have new collections out. We'll talk to them later in our program. We begin our show today, though, in southwest Fresno, the golden west side of Fresno, as many there call it. It's one of the oldest parts of town, home to a rich African-American community, and jewels like Edison High, Chandler Airport, and Kearney Boulevard. But it's also been a place that has been largely overlooked by city planners, a place some who live there have called a dumping ground for industries and activities that the rest of Fresno didn't want next door, like heavy polluting industrial businesses. Now, after decades of complaints, the neighborhood might finally have the ear of the city council. A vote this week, in fact, could signal what activists think is a new direction for southwest Fresno. The council is considering a new specific plan for the area that will guide the future of the more than 3,000-acre neighborhood west of Highway 99 and south of Highway 180. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports one significant change could address years of concerns by telling heavy industry to go elsewhere.
When she was a little girl, Kimberly McCoy lived near some of the heavy industry that marks part of southwest Fresno. Because of the pollution, McCoy says she developed severe asthma.
I was hospitalized twice with pneumonia in the summertime because of my asthma. I was actually placed in an oxygen bubble. So yes, it was really bad.
McCoy says her asthma was so bad that her mother had to quit her job to care for her. Her doctors even suggested that the family leave Fresno to find better air, something impossible for a single mother raising two children. Now 43 years old, McCoy is a mother herself. Still living in southwest Fresno, she says history has repeated itself, and her son has also developed severe asthma.
My son is 4 years old, full of life, but when the air quality is bad, I have to keep him in. And to see the look on his face because he can't go outside and play because of the air quality, he doesn't understand that.
McCoy directly blames the pollution from heavy industry in southwest Fresno for her and her son's conditions. Air pollution is problematic throughout the Central Valley, and especially in Fresno. However, research shows it's especially bad in southwest Fresno. According to the state, some of the most polluted areas in all of California are in southwest Fresno. In part because of the pollution, life expectancy of residents is 2 decades shorter than other neighborhoods. As a result, she got involved in the work crafting a new planning document to guide development in her neighborhood. And her one goal? No more heavy industrial developments.
The stench in the air is very, very terrible. So they're not good neighbors. They're bad neighbors. So we do not want them placed in South Fresno anymore, because that's where they're normally placed at. And residents in South Fresno deserve to have a chance. They deserve to have a healthy neighborhood, clean air, and we just do not want those type of facilities placed there.
And she might be about to get her wish. For the first time in decades, the Fresno City Council is set to vote this week on a new Southwest Fresno specific plan. That's a document intended to lay down ground rules for what can and can't be built in certain areas of town. It would make a number of sweeping changes, but the most dramatic is phasing out all industrial zoning. The entire area would be rezoned for residential, office, and commercial uses only. Fresno planning manager Sophia Pagalotis says southwest Fresno is one of few areas with heavy industrial zoning, like meat rendering plants, recycling, and raw goods processing, located near homes. Under the plan, if an industrial business wants to change their facility, they would have to move to another part of town. The hope is that they would also take some of the negative impacts, like air and noise pollution, with them.
Operating characteristics of an industrial business affect residential neighborhoods in different ways. So one of those is truck traffic. So that's not only pollution, that's a safety concern, that's noise. We have sometimes the business itself makes noise.
Pagliotta says about 5% of all industrial businesses in the city of Fresno are within the plan's reach. The plan does not say where the companies would move to, but Pagliotta says the city is looking at options that would concentrate industry in similarly zoned areas. Ashley Werner with the Leadership Council on Justice and Accountability was one of the people heavily involved with drafting the proposed specific plan. She says even though industrial businesses won't be forced to relocate right away, the plan is a positive step for the community.
What it does do is say that we're going to stop in our tracks with new industrial development. And so that vacant parcels or as existing industry phases out over time will be replaced by retail, housing opportunities, mixed use.
Werner also thinks this change will attract better commercial choices and draw wealthier people from other parts of town. This plan is hardly without its detractors. During public comment before the city council, two prominent local developers warned about making the rules too restrictive with regards to what type of housing can be built and where. Eliminating all industrial zoning has skeptics, even among people who've fought against pollution for years, like Bob Mitchell. Mitchell told the city council that by phasing out all industry, including lower polluting light industry, they would, in his words, shoot yourself in the foot.
And I am saying that future requires that there be a positive form of industry for employment for those who will reside in our community. Every industry is not a negative polluter. Every industry will not give us bad health.
Additionally, phasing out industry over time will do little to help with the pollution problem in the short term. If a business doesn't change, it doesn't have to move. There's nothing in the plan about cleaning up former industrial sites or air quality, although the city says cleaning up a polluted site is normally the job of the company. The plan is also mum on where the industry would move to if it cannot be in southwest Fresno, so there's the potential that other communities could suffer. However, the plan as a whole might position the area for new money that could help in the short term. The state has promised to spend $70 million from cap and trade funds for green projects and transportation. Mapping out a detailed, specific plan with an eye away from industry might make the area more attractive to state regulators. The vote on initially accepting the plan and beginning the environmental review is set for Thursday. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. This Thursday night, Fresno art lovers will be out on the town enjoying the city's monthly Art Hop event. But this month, the first Thursday also has an added component at Arte Americas, an event organizers are calling Book Hop. It's a chance to meet local authors and purchase some of their newest works. Last week, we heard from David Moss Masamoto and his daughter Nikiko, who have their own new books and will be at the event. Today, we hear from two more authors, Doug Hansen, who will join us in a little bit on our show, and right now, Armin Bacon. Her new book is titled My Name is Armin, Outside the Lines, Volume 2, a collection of essays, some of which have appeared in the Fresno Bee. Armin Bacon, welcome.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Good morning.
Outside the Lines. What do you mean by that?
I knew you were going to ask that. Well, you know, years ago, I met a woman who was approaching 90, and she was a very inspiring lady who lived on the edge, was very creative, and she dared me to live my life. And in my writing, when I first started writing, I think I tried to play it safe. I didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings. I wanted to write happy stories that could be tied up at the end with a lovely bow, and they all lived happily ever after. And in volume two of My Name is Armin, I've tried to color outside the lines and paint a portrait of our valley and the community a little more honestly. And I love the valley. And it's so rich in its people and its stories. And I'm a storyteller. And so I've tried to take a few more risks with my writing in this volume. And I hope readers will enjoy it.
You've divided the essays in this book up into four sections. Is there any thematic nature behind that?
Well, I tried to do it so that a story of its own unfolds about life and about my life, and it really, in each section, there's a painting of the people that I'm interacting with, my family, my friends, situations of life, and basically the overall theme is about the human condition and how beautiful and yet how fragile life is. So I think readers get a taste of all those things in each section.
Speaking of the fragility of life, you write about some current events and things that happen in our community, some stories that are very powerful that many of our listeners may remember, the story of Melissa Carrollton, the woman in Fresno who gave birth to a child, a healthy child, even though she had undergone surgery for a brain tumor. She is still alive, but is under care now. That story, also the story of the death of Janessa Ramirez, the 9-year-old who was shot and killed in gang violence in Fresno in 2015. How difficult is it to take a story out of the headlines and find something new, something in a powerful way to say about it that's not just dwelling on the negative?
You know, that's a very special question. I think, as a woman, as a mom who's lost a child, I've tried to allow myself to be vulnerable. And in both of those situations, with both of those stories, they were absolute chance meetings. They weren't scheduled interviews. I wasn't going out determined to write a story about either one of those families. But we met, you know, Luana and John Carlton, I met in a restaurant. And we just happened to make eye contact. We met in the parking lot. And one comment led to another, another. And the same with Janessa's story. I was doing an interview, and her father happened to be in the studio. And the energy was electric. It was different. We all felt the sorrow and the pain. And my goal as a writer is to articulate, to put those emotions into words. And I know a lot of my readers tell me, thank you for putting words to something I was feeling, but I didn't know how to describe. And so, and again, that's how I'm trying to push the envelope with my own writing and share the innermost feelings of the human condition.
Fresno author Armin Bacon joins us today. You mentioned the community reaction to some of the stories that you write in The Bee. Do they ever surprise you? Do you ever think that, oh, I'm going to write this essay, it's going to be in the paper, and I, this is what people are going to say, and then they say something different?
Well, let me just tell you, people think it's an easy job to write a story and then press the send button and send it off to whether it's a Fresno Bee or a magazine or wherever I'm being published. It's terrifying for me because I'm talking about not only my story, but about other people's lives and our community. And, you know, as an author, you have to take that risk. It feels like jumping off of a high dive because you don't know. Sometimes people will applaud you and say, oh my God, that's exactly how I was feeling. Thank you. And other times they may throw tomatoes at you. And I've had both reactions. Overall, I have an incredible readership and fans and friends and family who thank me for writing the stories I write because they really talk about the beauty and gloriousness of this Central Valley that we all live in. And so overall, the reactions are very positive. But sometimes I'm really surprised. And sometimes what's even most surprising for me is how I will discover a story. One of my favorite ones in this volume, too, is a man that I've been working out with in a private little gym for a long, long time. And one day we were just pausing and sitting together on a workout bench, and he said, can I tell you a story? And he ended up telling me a story about when he graduated from college. He was out on his first job, and he was having dinner by himself, and a woman across the restaurant invited him to join him to join her, and it turned out to be Marilyn Monroe, and my jaw just dropped, you know, listening to his story, and I ended up writing that, and it's a lot of people's favorite story in the book.
You mentioned that you write these stories not just about the events of the day, but how your own interactions with people and your day to day life. Starting out, did you find it easier to write about your own experiences or easier to write about other people and tell their story?
Well, you know, my first book was Griefland, and it was my own story. And it was probably the hardest thing I ever did, trying to put words to my sorrow and my grief and talk about navigating sorrow and loss. And so it's probably a little bit easier talking about other people's stuff. When I write about my own feelings and emotions, that's ripping my heart wide open and sharing it like it is and being totally, completely honest. But what I've found is that at the end of the day, we are all so much more alike than we are different. And that's really a very important part of why I write. That plus I want to make sure to pass down my stories to my children and my grandchildren. I think we're all living in this speed dial age, in this digital age, where everybody is running at such a fast pace that we don't stop and reflect and share the way maybe our grandparents or parents did. And so I'm kind of determined to do that through my writing and through my storytelling.
It's been 12 years since you lost your son, and you told that story very eloquently in that book you just mentioned. Do people still come up to you and tell you how that book and the way you told that story affected them?
Yes. No matter where I speak or whatever crowd I may find myself in, there's always at least one person in the room who will connect with me at the end of the day to say, me too. I'm experiencing loss also. And in fact, you know, during this holiday season, it's really a hard time for a lot of families who are struggling with children who they've lost or kids going through struggles. And I think it's very important for us to share our stories. And again, so that we don't leave others feeling like they're alien and they're the only ones experiencing that. And but Griefland was one of those stories that so many families, more than we can ever imagine, are also experiencing.
You mentioned the holidays. This is a difficult time for many who have lost loved ones. How has, you know, now 12 years on, how has your experience changed?
You know, I think I'm doing pretty well. And yet, in reality, I think you learn to carry the grief and to, of course, writing is a huge help for me. I write about it when I'm feeling it, and that helps a lot. But you learn basically how to walk through life with that gigantic crack running down your middle. And it doesn't mean that you don't love and experience joy and have a great day or a wonderful month, but it's always there. It's like a little monster that's sitting on your shoulder that walks around with you. And, you know, when I talk to families, you know, it's not something you get over. It's something that you integrate into your person. And any way you get through grief is heroic. There's no right or wrong way to do it. And I think my book and also my storytelling is to remind people to be compassionate and to be gentle with each other, because you never know what's going on behind that velvet curtain of somebody else's life. I chose to write about it, to live out loud, to share my story, to say it like it is. But for a lot of people, it's very private, very personal. It's not something that they want to speak and share. And so I hope that my book has helped others. And in both Volume 1 and Volume 2 of My Name is Armin, I have several chapters that address that issue, because I don't want people to think it goes away magically. It's always here.
Another theme in this new book and in your other works as well is your Armenian heritage.
Yes.
You write about Fresno's Armenian heritage.
Yes.
Tell me about that and what you talk about in this particular collection.
Well, you know, I grew up in Little Armenia in southeast Fresno, and I think that's that sense of rootedness and that sense of family. And, you know, I can go almost anywhere in Fresno, and there are no strangers. I'm surrounded by aunties and uncles and extended family. And, you know, I think that's probably why I have been so resilient and why I've been able to survive the worst day of my life. I love my culture and heritage, and I love living in the Valley. And I think the contributions of Armenian people, and certainly writer William Saroyan, he was my original inspiration for becoming a writer. He was somebody, when I was growing up, that I saw at the downtown library every Saturday when my mom dropped me off. And later in life, I read his works, and he spoke to the human spirit. And I think I try to emulate a lot of the themes that he wrote about the importance of family, about life's journey, about navigating life with passion and purpose.
Walk me through your creative process. You talked briefly about this, how, and sometimes it's an encounter with somebody at the gym or something like that that may prompt a column. Do you keep a notepad and say, oh, I want to maybe use this as an idea or a kernel for something that might eventually become an essay? And then do you go off of those, and are some rejected? What's Armin Bacon's creative process like?
Well, I have paper and pencil and pen and tablet everywhere, in every room of my house, in my car, in the trunk of my car, in my purse, wherever I am, you will find paper and pen. But I love writing early, early in the morning or very, very late at night when all those internal critics and censors are sleeping, because it's during those times when I can write freely and without interruptions and without telling myself this is a horrible sentence. And so I have running ideas, and I may be driving on my way here to be interviewed, and a sentence will come into my mind, and I jot it down and take it home with me and then play with it for a few hours later on in the day. But I love the creative process, but it's also a discipline. I had a writing professor once tell me, the harder you work, the luckier you'll get in terms of being published. And it's so true. I mean, I devote 3 to 4 hours every day to writing. And some days I throw it all away, and other days in the first paragraph I find something that turns into a great story. So it's, but you've got to stay at it. And I'm always asked by young people or emerging writers, you know, what should I do? And I said, you have to write every day. I mean, that's the most important part. And some days you'll come up with gold, and other days an idea will have to lay dormant for a while before it materializes into magic.
What do you hope people will take away after reading your book?
Well, I hope that they realize what a special place Fresno and the San Joaquin Valley is. This is home for many of us. And for all the negative things that get written about Fresno and the Central Valley, it's really an incredible, amazing place. And it's the people that make it so special. I also hope that people will take away the notion that we're all in this together. We, you know, no one is exempt from the ups and downs of life. It's the human condition, and it's beautiful, it's messy, it's glorious, it's sad, and it's joyous. It's all those things. But to be truly human, I think you have to experience life with all of those emotions. And I'm very grateful for our community. This book, as you probably know, was published by the press at California State University, Fresno, and Mary and Joe Castro wrote the foreword. And I'm so proud of that, because Fresno State, in fact, I dedicated this book to Fresno State, my paradise on the northeast corner of Cedar and Shaw, because it is Fresno State that continued to welcome me back every time I decided I wanted to be someone different and grow and stretch and dare to live my life a little differently. And at the age of 57, I went back to school to become a writer, and I'm still going back to that campus, and they continue to welcome me with open arms. So I'm very grateful to this community, to the Castros, to Fresno State, and this is home.
The book is called My Name is Armin, Outside the Lines, Volume 2, a collection of essays. You can find Armin and the book Thursday night at Arte Americas in the event organizers are calling Book Hop. It's part of Art Hop, and an opportunity to meet Armin and a number of other local authors and find that book. Armin, thank you so much.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Of course, Book Hop is not just about essayists and nonfiction writers. There's a children's book and children's author and illustrator on the bill as well. Joining us now is Doug Hansen. He is the author and illustrator of the new book, California, The Magic Island. Doug, welcome.
Thank you.
A lot of our listeners are familiar with your work through your years doing your illustrations in the Fresno Bee, the sketchbook series mm-hmm. that was in the Sunday Spotlight series for many years, and the books that came out of that as well. A children's book, but this is not a new venture for you. You've been doing children's books for a while now. Tell us how this fits into what you've done.
I have been doing children's books for a while. When I left the Fresno Bee and began teaching illustration at Fresno State, I finally had something wonderful called a summer vacation that allowed me the months that I needed to do the kind of picture making that I really wanted to do. And over a period of 5 years, I did a book called Mother Goose in California, which was published by Heyday Books at the time. And they didn't usually do children's books, but because of the California theme, which you can kind of imagine from the title, Mother Goose in California, it continues to be a success. And I was so happy and so excited to do that book. And when the publisher offered me the opportunity to follow that up with something else, he made some suggestions, and one of them was Aesop, and that became Aesop in California. And so I followed up on this theme of what somebody called California-centric children's books, and California the Magic Island is the newest.
So now this is a story, or at least has a story that's rooted in mythology that goes back hundreds of years. Tell us about why it's called California the Magic Island.
I'll try to keep it as brief as I can, but it came from a romance that was written in the 16th century by a Spaniard. And it was about a knight, but in his adventures he encounters Queen Calafia, a beautiful black woman who rules an island of Amazon women that's populated with red griffins and loaded with gold, which always seemed to capture the Spaniard's interest. And even though it was a novel, even though it was a story, the myth, I think, was so powerful that the earliest Spanish explorers creeping up the California coast when they encountered the Baja Peninsula, I think they were pretty sure that this was Queen Calafia's island. And so I use that as kind of the germ of an idea to hang a whole bunch of little stories about California on.
So how do you take it from there throughout in a nutshell? Obviously, this is a beautiful, beautifully illustrated book. There's also text here. Tell us about what you're talking about. And I just opened one page, The Forestier Underground Gardens is one example, but it's not just Fresno or Central Valley specific.
No, that's the Underground Gardens. It was an apt choice. In the book, the animals of California, one by one, tell stories about their experiences in California to Queen Calafia, trying to explain to her and help her understand why their California is every bit as magical, beautiful, terrifying, and wonderful as her magic island. Well, you'll have to read the book to find out how successful they are. But each animal tells a story that takes up one page, and there just conveniently happen to be 26 stories, one for each letter of the alphabet. So, for example, the story of Balthazar Forestier in the Underground Gardens is told by a couple of ground squirrels. And, of course, they can relate to this human who's burrowing underground just the way that they do. And so I took a night tour for my research, took a night tour of the Underground Gardens and took some photos, took some notes, did some other research, which I did for all the stories in the book. I got to travel all over California for California, the Magic Island.
Now, this is a book for children ages 6 and up. A lot of children's authors work with an illustrator. You have the opportunity here to do your own thing. Tell me about that.
I do, absolutely. I have the best possible situation. I can make my writing support the kind of pictures that I want to make. And I'm an artist first and striving to become a better writer. So if people would think of me as an illustrator that writes then that would be a good way to think about it. I work in watercolor. I do little sketches first and kind of block out what the picture is going to look like. My colors are pretty vivid, probably because I grew up in the psychedelic era during the late 60s and was hugely influenced by that look. But as well, but I'm influenced as well by traditional classic children's books. And if you get to see a copy of California the Magic Island, or when you see it, you'll see that it's very much presented in a classic children's book formula or format with, I hope, beautiful glowing colors, gold foil lettering on the cover, cloth cover, just like the kind of books that I loved and enjoyed so much when I was a child.
The kind of book that can become a hand-me-down, a treasured heirloom as well. So
I hope.
A lot of your work, I would say much of it that people are very familiar with, all is very rooted in place. Going all the way back, not only to your work in The Bee, but back to the coloring book that you did about Fresno that I still see copies popping up every once in a while on eBay or at an antique store. Tell me about that, because that was, you talked about the influence from the psychedelic era, definitely evident in that book. How did that come about? What made you, as a young artist in the, I guess it was 70s at that point,
that's right,
decide to do a coloring book?
It's remarkable that you would ask me that, because I gave a presentation just a week ago to some arts educators about art inspired by place, and they asked me to talk about that. And my dad was in the Navy, and even though I was born in Fresno, I didn't live in Fresno until 1970 when we moved here, and I began as an art student at Fresno State. And so I was kind of maybe a little bit of a wise guy teenager at 18 years old. I'm looking at Fresno, and it seemed to me like the place was filled with just oddities, you know, roadside attractions and things like that were getting my attention. Once I started working at the Fresno Bee, I settled down a little bit. I was so honored to be part of the great art department that still exists at the Fresno Bee, although in a much reduced form. I was there for more than 20 years and worked with great artists and illustrators and journalists. And, you know, that was my day-to-day training as an artist. And I just grew to become, you know, so fond of Fresno and have and feel like I have kind of an understanding, or at least an appreciation of just how the everyday can be extraordinary if you pay attention to it. And when I started creating my children's books, I tried to expand on that theme a little bit. And because when I did Mother Goose, how many Mother Goose books are there in the world? How many artists? Thousands, at least. What could I do that was different? So I asked myself, what do I know? You know, what is authentic? What is legitimate? And I knew about California, and I knew that I could talk about that. And the more I thought about it, about bringing Mother Goose to California, the more I realized, oh my gosh, this state has got everything, you know, every kind of landscape that you can imagine, you know, so many different kinds of animals and creatures, and a remarkable history that an artist that's really visually oriented can draw upon to create, I hope, wonderful pictures. And so that's what I've kind of been inspired to do throughout my art career.
It's a great sentiment to take a look around what's immediately around us and maybe linger a while and see things in a new light. Again, acclaimed illustrator and now children's book author Doug Hansen joins us. The new book is called California, the Magic Island. It's a beautifully illustrated full-color children's book for ages 6 and up that takes us on a fantastical journey through the Golden State and through the eyes of a number of different animals. You're going to be out at Book Hop on Thursday night as part of Art Hop. And again, that's at Arte Americas, 5 to 8 p.m. Doug, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment with more of Valley Edition as we kick off the newest episode of our podcast, Outdoorsy, all about ideas, tips, and discussion for outdoor enthusiasts. This week, where to take your dog in the Sierra. That's coming up straight ahead on Valley Edition.
During an election year, news coverage can start to sound the same. And that's where NPR comes in.
I'm Asma Khalid.
Domenico Montanaro.
Sam Sanders.
Scott Detrow.
Danielle Kurtzleben.
Carrie Johnson.
To tell stories about the election from all different angles.
I cover demographics and the campaign.
Political editor.
Campaign reporter.
Cover tech and politics.
Digital political reporter.
Justice correspondent.
We take you on a journey.
White House correspondent.
Through the issues.
And I cover Congress.
And inform you about the world as it changes. Listen every day.
Starting at 4 o'clock on Valley Public Radio.
Do you remember your first time?
My first time? First time of what?
It's a little uncomfortable. Should I talk about it now?
Your first time listening to NPR's Morning Edition, that is.
I was 6 years old riding around in my parents' car, and I was like, what is this stuff? And I just kept listening.
No matter how many times you've listened, listen again tomorrow to Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm Marv Allen. Join me tomorrow morning between 3 a.m. and 9 for Morning Edition on Valley Public Radio.
This is Valley Edition. The newest episode in our podcast, Outdoorsy, is next.
Sally started crying and yelping, and I ran up real quick, and a mountain lion had her.
Hey guys, I'm Ezra David Romero.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This is Outdoorsy, a podcast from Valley Public Radio.
We take you to wild places in Central California and introduce you to people who explore them.
Today, we talk less about humans and more about our pets, specifically dogs.
Neither of us have dogs, but hiking with them looks like a lot of fun.
But our friends also talk about how tough it can be to find dog-friendly hiking spots and to keep them safe. So this episode is all about where to take them,
where not to take them,
and how to prep them for the outdoors if they're not quite ready yet.
And we'll end the show with a place where both humans and animals can get a treat.
We knew there was only one way to do this story. Spend some time with dogs and their people. We invited four buddies with furry friends to join us for a day in the woods. Meet Nora, Duke, Bart, and Puma Diego.
Hi, you guys. So sorry. Hi.
We began at a giant grove of sequoias. It's not in a national park. In fact, it's a place even many locals don't know about. It's called Nelder Grove. It's not too far away from the mountain town of Oakhurst and about an hour and a half from Fresno. A few miles north of town on Highway 41, you turn right onto a country road and twist and turn for 7 miles. We met up with Brenda Negley, a local volunteer and guide with a long history in this area.
My grandparents were the first volunteer hosts up here at Nelder Grove. Actually, there's a tree up here named after them. That tree is the Hawksworth tree. My husband proposed to me under that tree.
Brenda's worked here as a camp host for 8 years. And she even wrote a book about the area. She says this grove of 99 sequoia trees has seen a lot of change.
10 to 15,000 years ago, the North Fork Mono lived and traveled through here. 5,000 years ago, it was the Southern Sierra Miwok. But the American Indians, this place was called a pass-through. It was almost like the highway of the day back then, with the trails that interconnected where the different groups would travel through. Galen Clark was here in 1858, named the area Fresno Grove at the time. It's now known as Nelder Grove. Robert E. Cleston in 1851 with the Mariposa Battalion, though, were the first European Americans to be here.
At one time, there were over 350 giant sequoias here, but over 250 of them were lost to logging. In the late 1800s, John Muir stumbled upon this wilderness while he was trekking across the Sierra Nevada, and he found something surprising, a cabin with a man living in it.
So he met John Nelder. John Nelder had just finished building his cabin up in Nelder Basin. And that's where they both met. And then he stayed here for about a week and a half while John Nelder and John Muir explored the grove. And Nelder showed him the trees, his pet trees, everything unique to the grove.
The area features interpretive trails with log cabins from that era and a really cool handmade replica of the grove, complete with topography and trees. Today, the grove is protected from logging, but felled trees still scar the landscape, slowly decomposing.
So here at the Interpretive Center, we have a giant stump. I call it the big stump. And then off to, southwest is a giant log. So that log that you see right there came from this stump. That log's been on the ground for 150 years, still has not decomposed. It is solid.
That history was interesting to the humans among us. But after a long conversation, the dogs were ready to go. We took them on a 1.5 mile hike and stopped at a sequoia tree that had been hollowed out by lightning.
Feels so good. The shade.
Right.
Let's have lunch inside this tree.
Yeah, right?
We could totally do that.
We munched on sandwiches and snacks while the dogs caught their breath. We decided to take this opportunity to talk about dog-friendly hiking.
Finding places to take your dogs in the outdoors can be surprisingly hard because every type of land has different guidelines. In Kings Canyon, Sequoia, and Yosemite National Parks, dogs have to be on leash and generally can't go on trails. But in wilderness areas, places owned by the Bureau of Land Management, and in Forest Service lands, like Nelder Grove, dogs are welcome and sometimes allowed off-leash. To be safe, it's a good idea to look up the dog rules and always carry a leash just in case.
But the rules aren't the only challenges. We asked our friends what they find tough about hiking with dogs and why they sometimes decide to leave their pets behind and hike solo. Our friend Christine loves the outdoors, but today is her first hike with her dog Duke. Duke is an adorable little furball, and Christine's worried that he'll look delicious to wild animals.
The first thought that comes to mind for me is, what's a wildlife situation like out here, animal-wise? All right.
On the other side of the spectrum, our friend Michelle takes her dog Bart into the wilderness about once a week. She's had the time and experience to solve the challenges she comes up against. For one thing, her old dog used to get tired on the trail, so she'd actually carry him out.
Her new dog Bart can't go on trails in national parks, so she's found dozens of other nice dog hikes, like Shaver Lake, Courtright Reservoir, Toll House, and her favorite, the Eastern Sierra.
And what's maybe most impressive is the training she's found to help Bart behave in the outdoors, including rattlesnake aversion therapy, which involves an electric collar.
They then have these rattlesnakes in these containers. So they take them to a couple different containers, then when they get to the container that has a snake, they'd use the collar up at a pretty high level to do negative reinforcement, and then they run. So they teach the dog to, if they smell the rattlesnake, to run instead of staying right there. So it's good because they teach them what the smell, what they sound like, and what they move like. So if they see it out in the wild, they're not going to go, oh, what's that? Like, Bart's a hunting breed. He doesn't need to be going hunting rattlesnakes.
This training thing, it hit a note for our friend Mackenzie, whose dog Nora is unpredictable and sometimes uncontrollable.
She's an entirely different dog off the leash than she is on the leash. On the leash, she's anxious, she's pulling, she's jumping on people. You take her off and she just is free. My right arm is probably way more muscular than my left at this point, just from walking her. There's a stupid joke that everyone's always like rolling their window down and they're like, you walking the dog or is a dog walking you, sort of thing, every time I walk her at home, because she is pretty strong. So yeah, I'm not interested in a leash walk. If I don't do it unless I have to.
Mackenzie's concern is a pretty common one: how to control your dog so you both enjoy the outdoors. We wanted to know the answer too.
So a few days after the hike, we interviewed Candace Gregory. She's a retired firefighter and a writer based near Oakhurst who blogs about hiking with her dog.
My dog is Sally E. Smith. Every dog needs to have a last name and a middle name. And she's a Weimaraner, and she's 5 years old.
Candace has been hiking with Sally for years, all throughout the valley and the Sierra Nevada. She says the keys to making a dog wilderness ready are understanding your dog and training it.
I think training is a biggie. And Sally went to training. So I'm not perfect at training dogs by long ways. If they haven't been out on leash and haven't been on hikes or walks, keeping them on leash and in control is an important thing. And some dogs don't play well with others. But knowing your dog is probably the best advice I can have, and knowing their limitations. And sometimes you'll see dogs out on the trail that have muzzles on them. And it's not because they're necessarily mean dogs, but it's because that owner is being responsible and making sure that that dog doesn't have an opportunity to do something bad. And many, many times it's you that need the training and not the dog.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point. Tell us more about that.
You know, a lot of times I think when a dog trainer trains a dog really would like to please and do well. But sometimes we don't know how to make that happen. And a trainer has been around the block many, many times and seen all different kinds of things, and they can see what you're doing wrong and help you give good, clear, consistent cues to your dog.
It may sound pretty basic, but Candace reminds us it's important to pack supplies for your dog, not just water and food, but maybe a water filtration system and a lightweight water bowl. She also carries a doggy first aid kit, ointment for sore paws, and little dog booties.
Talk to me about the boots that you put on your dog.
Okay.
Are those actual little boots?
Like they sure are.
Boots?
I should have brought some to show you. I mean, Sally has outfits. And so she has different boots to go with her outfits, too.
So she has some real thin ones that are more, I carry in a pack as a backup emergency in case I have to put them on. And she also has snow boots that go up to her knees. She has bright orange boots that she can do a whole hike on the whole day in, and they have a little grippy thing on the bottom, kind of like our Vibram soles.
So she doesn't mind being all decked out?
Sadly, I think she likes it.
Yeah, because some dogs I probably wouldn't like to have things on their feet.
Oh, the first time I put them on Sally, and if you put them on your dog the first time, it is hilarious. Have your video ready, because they are stepping high and prancing, and it's weird, but they get used to it pretty darn quick.
Okay, so we've talked about training, food, and water, sweaters and boots, maybe, but what about Christine's question? Are dogs really in danger?
Yeah, she has an answer for that, and it's actually a little tough to hear.
Well, there are animals around, and there are animals that like to eat our animals. And Sally's had one of those experiences. Sally is a very lucky dog. A couple years ago, we were hiking up at Shut-Eye Pass, which is in the Sierra National Forest above Bass Lake. And Sally was walking about 20 feet or so out in front of me, and we had four hikers that day following an old dozer trail. There was a low spot on the dozer trail, and Sally started crying and yelping, and I ran up real quick, and a mountain lion had her. It had Sally's head in its mouth and was trying to break its neck. It had all of its feet and claws hooked into Sally and wasn't letting her go. And as I was yelling at the mountain lion, it gave me just the nastiest look, and I started backing away. I figured Sally was a goner. And I wasn't running away. I was just slowly backing away. And then my hiking partner, Rick, ran up with his hiking pole and started beating on the mountain lion. And the mountain lion did let go of Sally. And I had Sally heal, and we backed out and walked back to the car. She had lots and lots of stitches, and her personality didn't change, and she still lives hiking and all. But I'm a little more cautious taking Sally in mountain lion country. I don't blame the mountain lion at all for the attack. It was doing what it did, and we were in that mountain lion's backyard. But there are other hazards out there also, such as rattlesnakes and other critters, and those are hazards that I try to make people aware of in the blog so that they can decide whether that's a good hike for their dog or maybe keep the dog on leash. You should always have control of your dog, even when you're out in the woods. And some dogs are more controllable than others on leash and off leash.
So I wonder if you have advice for people who may think that this sounds really intimidating. I mean, for people who haven't brought their dogs out before, it's like, okay, know your dog really well, start them out on small hikes, bring lots of supplies. I mean, that might sound like a really tough undertaking if you've never done it before. Is it worth it to try to go through all these steps?
Well, if you like to walk and hike, and if your dog likes to walk and hike, I think there's probably a hike out there that you both can do together. And start small. It could just be walking down the street or in your local park. And don't let it overwhelm you. I have a goal in life of having one adventure a week. And when you go out on a hike, I like to have unexpecteds, not mountain lion attacks, but being open to looking and seeing what you're experiencing out there on the hike, whether it's a beautiful fall leaf or a reflection in a creek or the snow-covered mountains. To me, you kind of get these awe moments when you see something unexpected. And sometimes your dog helps you find those things. They may find something that you would have missed, and both of you experiencing that together kind of makes it a fun hike for myself.
If this is still all worth it to you, at the end of the day, know that there's a place you can treat yourself and your pet.
This is Benicera Pinot Grigio.
We're talking about a dog-friendly wine bar called Yosemite Wine Tales.
It's served cold, and you sip it.
It's located right on Highway 41 in the middle of Oakhurst and about a half an hour from Nelder Grove.
Cling, cling.
Cheers,
nice.
Cheers to Wine Tales.
Yay.
Cheers. And the puppy breath. Yes.
Colette Goga runs the bar. From the outside, it looks like every other business on this street. But inside, there's plenty of space for people and their pets.
While humans peruse a long list of wine, beer, and other goodies, every four-legged patron gets a free treat and water from doggy water fountains.
Colette and her husband also run a feed store and an animal boarding house. They love helping animals and their owners.
I have taken those two passions and then turned it into a place where people can come, sit down, and maybe explore wines that they, under normal circumstances, wouldn't necessarily drink. If you're a Chardonnay fan, then it's time to come to Yosemite Wine Tales and try a Malbec or a blend or maybe something sweet. We aren't pretentious. We're not going to tell you what to drink first, second, and third, but I will offer things that I believe will appeal to different individuals based on their tastes, wants, needs, desires. And we do offer craft beer.
Are you still going to try to just bark at me?
I think he's saying he's thirsty.
While we're sipping wine, the dogs get a little restless, but Colette knows what to do. She walks over to a few tables covered with what looks like pastries and cookies.
So all those delicious things in the window are not for us?
They are not. Aren't they amazingly wonderful looking? I mean, really and truly, the cannolis look like cannolis. There are cinnamon rolls that genuinely look like cinnamon rolls. There's some little truffle things. Those are all doggy cookies.
Cinnamon roll. Thank you. Thank you.
And as we move on to red wine, Colette tells us more about her motivation for opening this dog-friendly wine bar. It all comes back to her relationship with her dog.
The passion that people have for their animals and wanting to take them with them wherever they go. And that relationship between, you know, I call them fur kids and their owners, it's a bond, and it's amazing. So the marriage there is to have people come in and enjoy a beer or a glass of wine and have their pet legitimately able to come in and just be without having to label it a service dog or something to that effect. So why? The answer is because I love my dog, and I am paying that forward. I think most people that have dogs have that same passion for their fur kid, and they want to go everywhere. I could be wrong. I don't think so, but I could be.
And that's today's show. Check out our website for other dog-friendly hikes in the Central Valley and share a picture with your dog or your favorite hiking spot on Instagram or Twitter. We're at Outdoorsy Pod on both.
Our editor is Joe Moore, and we had engineering help from Don Weaver.
Our music is by Kevin McLeod and Ben Sound.
Stay tuned for future shows when we visit other wild places and interview the people who love them. For Outdoorsy, I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Ezra David Romero. Thanks for listening.
See ya.
Bye.
And that's it for today's Outdoorsy and for Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can send us an email, talk@kvpr.org. And if you're on Twitter, we are @kvpr and @Valley Edition. You can also find audio archives, our podcasts, and more online at kvpr.org. For the Outdoorsy team of Ezra David Romero and Carrie Klein, as well as reporter Jeffrey Hess, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. We hope to see you again next week for another Valley Edition here on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment, Health Happens When California Values Schools More Than Prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.